So our topic for consideration this evening is why I am a believer, and we'll ask our brother Gordon to come forward and give that to us.
Well, thank you, Clive, and good evening, everyone. I really do appreciate the opportunity of being able to share with you tonight why I am a believer. It's, of course, a very personal subject, but it's also a subject that's near and dear to the heart of anyone who believes. And so tonight what I would like to present the subject as a believer in God, a believer in the Bible, a believer in Jesus Christ, a believer in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and a believer in eternity. You might have noticed, if you came to this hall tonight down Mackenzie Avenue, if you crested the hill just before Blenkinsop there, you might have noticed the full moon rising. It's just a phenomenal sight. And tonight, when we're done here, you'll have the opportunity of seeing this new moon. Well, this full moon rather. What's the big deal? Well, I can't help but be amazed every time I witness a full moon. And so tonight, with the full moon coming on, I had to go out on my deck, as I often do, with my binoculars and just have another look. And it's just one of those amazing things that as the moon rises up in the sky and you see it going up, there are no cables, there's no crane, there's nothing there. It's just this giant orb that's just ascending up in the sky. And I look at that and just wonder and I'm amazed at the hand of God. And when I look at that, I'm a believer. Because the essential thing behind that full moon rising is that that moon was placed there for a reason. It was designed. Now, as I look through my binoculars, the brilliance of the moon is almost too much to look at with the naked eye. The glare is powerful as it reflects the light of the sun. But even the more brilliant thing is what is behind that moon. The Bible tells us in Psalm 14, verse 1, that the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. And my aim tonight is to demonstrate that only a fool would say that there is no God. And in fact, there are only two alternatives when it comes to God. We either believe that there is a God, or we don't believe that there is a God. There is no in-between on this. We can't believe halfway that there is a God. We either believe or we don't. And if we do not believe in God, then there is, of course, no creation. There is no design. There is no designer. That's just logic. And so, as a believer, I would like to present the evidence of design. Now, the evidence of design is everywhere. Now, we see the evidence right there this evening as that moon is rising above us. And so the psalmist, when he wrote that psalm, he reflected on that very same thing thousands of years ago. When he looked at the moon, and he looked at the stars, he saw that man was somehow related to this. And he said, what is man that thou art mindful of him, as he considered the creator and the creator, the created. But there is a relationship between that which is created and the creator. And so we look at the universe. We see the moon, the stars, the galaxies, the solar system. And if we can't marvel at that, what can we marvel at? It just goes on and on and on. There is no end. And yet everything is absolutely precise in its order. Do you know that NASA could not perform any of its space exploration if there was not order in the universe? Can you imagine when NASA launched its rocket for the moon landing, and the moon was just a random thing that some days it traveled at this speed and another day it traveled at a different speed and its orbit changed and it did erratic things? How could NASA ever have planned the moon landing? How could NASA ever have planned the Mars probe and sent a vehicle out into space to take a look at Mars? It could never have done it. And when you're talking those distances, we have to be aware that we are talking split, not just split seconds, but minute part of seconds. You cannot miscalculate. You cannot be out. And so the whole thing, the whole program of space exploration depends on absolute precision, absolute order in everything, not just upon the Earth. Not just in the solar system, but everything even beyond the solar system has to function with precision and with order. And someone could say that there is no design in that. One would have to indeed be a fool. But closer to home, there are things that just make me marvel, and I'm sure make you marvel as well. Our children going through the school system make excursions out to Goldstream Park, and there they witness the salmon spawning. And as they're taken through the cycle of the salmon, what they're taught, and when I first came to this part of the world and saw this, it made me marvel as well, that these salmon, they go out into the Pacific Ocean and travel thousands of miles, and never having done it before, and with no GPS system on board, these salmon can come to the very same river that they left. Now, how about that? And that just boggled my mind. When you look at a map of Vancouver Island and you see all of the rivers and streams that flow into the ocean on the west coast, and a salmon from way out in the Pacific Ocean can come back and find the very spot where it was spawned, that is truly a miracle. And so I marvel that the same teachers who teach the children about the salmon cycle can also teach them the theory of evolution. It makes absolutely no sense. In addition to the salmon, we could go on all night with the marvels of nature, but what about the migration of birds? And here again, we have amazing things taking place, from the migration of the small hummingbird to migration of much larger birds. And here again is still a mystery to science how these birds can find their way to where they go to nest and where they go to overwinter to avoid the harsh winter of the north. But one particular migration has caught my interest, and that is the migration of the monarch butterfly. You may be aware that the monarch butterfly, one of the most brilliantly coloured butterflies, on the western side of North America, the butterfly migrates to central Mexico. The monarchs on the eastern side of North America, they migrate into California. But these monarch butterflies that migrate down to the Oyamel forests in Mexico, in central Mexico, they do so without ever having done it before. Because the butterfly that actually makes that journey is a grandchild or great-grandchild of the butterfly that was there in the Oyamel forest. So there are many life cycles that take place between the butterfly that leaves that forest and the butterfly that returns back to that forest on a migration. Now, what is the possibility of finding that forest? It's not very big. And they find specific trees in that forest because the climate, the food sources and everything is just right, and it's imperative that they find that forest. If they did not find that forest, if, for example, they got all mixed up and their navigation got messed up and they went somewhere else, they could not possibly survive. The species would be absolutely extinct in one generation. And yet these forests go down, and if you've ever seen pictures of it, they just literally blanket those trees down there as they overwinter in Mexico. And the distance they travel, 2,000 to 3,000 miles. And you look at a butterfly and just wonder how a butterfly could ever travel that far. And the butterfly, like many species, is in peril because the monarch butterfly depends entirely on the milkweed as a food source. It's the only source of food for that butterfly. And milkweed is considered a noxious weed in the United States, and it is there is a process of eradication, and so the food source is being eradicated, and so it may well be that the monarch butterfly's days are indeed numbered. And with it will go just another sign of the hand of a wonderful designer. And so everywhere we look, surely we must, if we've got our eyes open, we must see the brilliance of design. I saw it today in a Cooper's hawk that flew far past my living room window. What an amazing bird that is. And just to see the agility of that hawk and to see its speed as it chases its prey, it's just a sight to behold. And again, it was designed. And it would be foolishness indeed if, you wouldn't even consider it if somebody said to you that the car that you drove in tonight to get here, it wasn't designed. It just sort of came together. You probably wouldn't even laugh. It wouldn't even be worth laughing at because it's so ridiculous. And so when we look at all of these marvels in nature, could we be so foolish that we would say, it wasn't designed? It sort of just developed that way. It's ridiculous, to say the least. But then we look at our own body. And even though we go through lots of physical problems in life, nevertheless, the body is just absolutely wonderfully made. And the eye is perhaps one of those things that is just, again, another indicator to us of the marvel of the designer. And because I have I've had glaucoma now for about 15 years, I'm caused to look at the eye on a frequent basis because I'm in to see an ophthalmologist every 2 to 3 months to have the eye examined. And we look at pictures of the eye, and I see charts in a room, and every time I look at this thing, and do you know that even the ophthalmologists, they don't know all about the eye? That simple? No, it's not as simple. But that small little organ in our body, they're still discovering all kinds of things about it. And when I look at that, I see that this is surely a marvelous design that can convert light waves into images inside the brain. And just considering the eye, how that lens to focus an image, how muscles push it one way and pull it the other way to thick make it thicker or make it thinner, so that the image becomes focused. Now that's great, because as we look down, we need to focus on something that's 12 inches in front of me, and when I look at you, I've got to focus again. So the eye is continually going through this focus operation. Every creature in the universe has to do the same thing. And a frog, for example, when it has to catch its prey, it has to focus its eye precisely on that insect that it's about to devour. And the frog, there are species of frog, and I don't know all about all the frogs, but I know at least one species, the lens is not focused in its eye by making it thicker or thinner. It actually focuses by moving the distance from the retina. So if I were to engage on a study of frogs, I'm sure I'd find that there's a reason for that. Why it doesn't do like our eye does, but why it rather the distance is changed, just like on in a camera, at least the old version cameras. So amazing indeed. But design produces awe. And I'd just like to share with you something out of the Psalms. And in Psalm 19, there's an important lesson on design that comes out. And here we are in Psalm 19. And in the Psalm, that it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge." That's what the heavens are telling us. That there is knowledge. That there is design. There is a creator. "There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world." Everybody has the opportunity to witness this knowledge. "In the heavens he has pitched a tent for the sun." In other words, the sun has its place. It's in exactly the right place. "Which is like a bridegroom coming forth from his pavilion, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is hidden from its heat." But then the psalm changes. He notices. It's talking about the heavens. Now all of a sudden, it talks about the law of the Lord. And it says, "The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever." So he's talking about teachings. And the psalmist is drawing the parallel between the created universe and God's teachings here in this book. And so what we see is the comparison that one brings the other. When we marvel at creation and we see the hand of God, then it brings us to the teachings of God that are also marvelous and radiant and transforming. And so one brings the other in a logical process of thought. And so the psalmist is moved to say that these teachings are more precious than gold. "By them is your servant warned, in keeping them there is great reward." And so you see how his mind goes from the eternal, the limitless creation of God, down to the things that we are taught here in his book. Psalm 139, while we're in the Psalms, Psalm 139, verse 14, tells us that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. "Your works are wonderful. I know that full well." And so the psalmist looks at his body and he recognizes that he's fearfully made. "My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body." And so he looks back to the time when he was formed in the womb of his mother and God was aware of that creation. But being wonderfully made and being fully aware of God's hand and how wonderfully he was designed and created, it brings a responsibility. And so this psalm concludes, "Search me, O God, and know my heart, test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. Take me into the eternal age," is what the psalmist is saying here. What a wonderful logical progression of thought. In Romans, the book of Romans in chapter 1, we are told this in verse 20. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. There is no excuse. If we look at that full moon tonight and we reject God, or we say there is no God, that there is no God, there is no excuse for not knowing him, because he has demonstrated his power in his creation. It's evident. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities have been clearly seen through the things that he has created. There is no one without excuse. There is no excuse that anyone can say that God has not revealed himself. And so, in Acts chapter 17, Paul, an apostle, he introduces a very interesting argument as he preaches the gospel to the Greeks. And this is what he says in verse 26 and 27 of Acts 17. He said to the Greeks in Athens, "So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, 'What is this babbler trying to say?' Others remarked, 'He seems to be advocating foreign gods.' They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. And so they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, 'May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean.' And so all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, 'Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. Now what you worship is something unknown. I am going to proclaim to you.'" And so he says, and I'm going to just go down just to save a little bit of time, just to go down a little bit in the discourse. He said in verse 28, "For in him," that is in God that he's proclaiming, the unknown God to the Athenians, "we live and move and have our being. As some of your own prophets have said, we are his offspring." So Paul is presenting the idea that we as humans are the offspring of God. And why does he introduce that? Well, he's making a connection. And so we cannot remove ourselves from God as the creator, our creator, because God is a moral God. And we, as humans, we have moral qualities. Now we might wonder sometimes in a very immoral age, where is the morality in mankind? But even convicts, even prisoners, have a sense of morality. If a pedophile is convicted and placed amongst the general population in a prison, he doesn't survive very long. The prisoners abhor and hate a pedophile, despite the fact that many of these men are murderers, violent men committing all kinds of different crimes. Someone who messes with a child is deemed to be unworthy to live, even by prisoners. And so there is a sense of morality, even in that extreme case. So God is a moral God. And we as offspring, we as created by God to be in his image, we have been given moral qualities and a sense of morality. But God is perfect morality. And that is what we are to aspire to. We haven't got there yet, any one of us. But our aim, our objective, is that we should be holy even as he is holy. And that's morality. So yes, I believe in God for various reasons, and for all of the reasons that I've just mentioned to you. But now I want to pass on to the Bible and why I believe in the Bible. I believe in the Bible for its conformity and its harmony. Reading the Bible now for many years, I don't find any disconnects. To me, the Bible is logical. It's understandable. Not always easy. Difficult in places. In fact, there are areas in the Bible that I still don't fully understand. But all of it makes sense. And it challenges. It's not a book that you can lay aside and say that you've read it, you know it, and you don't need to read it again. It's a book that continues to draw us in as we read from it. And so it has depth, it has morality, it has purity, it's scientifically sound, and it has an abundance of prophecies. In fact, in Isaiah 42 and verse 9, the prophet Isaiah tells us that God doesn't do anything, But God reveals his intentions, is what that verse is telling us. And just one other reason that I believe in this book, the Bible, above any other book. I've tried reading the Quran. I can't understand it. It's so disjointed. It's so illogical. It's so random. It's so abstract. I have found it to be an unreadable book. And I thought, well, maybe it's just me. You know, I'm just not maybe bright enough to understand this book. But then I've read others, comments by others who've tried reading the Quran, and they've come up with the same conclusion. And so the best that anyone can do with the Quran, if they want to accept the Quran and follow the Quran, is just take snippets out of it and follow those directions. But to read the book as a whole and get the flavor of the whole thing, I think it's virtually an impossible task. Not so with the Bible. Furthermore, the prophecies in the Bible are just too much to ignore. There is just too much evidence in the prophetical works in the Bible to ignore them. Now, I'm looking at the clock a little bit here, so I'm going to have to be somewhat brief. The prophecies regarding Israel as a nation are well known. And in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 30, for example, throughout this chapter, we have prophecies regarding the return of Israel as a nation to their own land. And we, of all people, have been privileged to see it happen. And my grandfather, he preached about Israel and the return of Israel, but he never saw the establishment of the nation because he died in 1947. But many faithful throughout the years anticipated the return of Israel to be established in the land, for the land to be called Israel and the nation to be called Israel. And that is proof positive to me that this book is divine. It was designed just as the moon was designed, as the stars were designed, as we were designed, as that little frog was designed, and everything that God created had design, so this book also was designed. It is called, in the New Testament, inspiration. And in 2 Timothy 3, 16-17, holy men of God spake as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. As God breathed into them his message, they wrote it down and they recorded it. An amazing feat, if it were not a miracle by God himself. Just as an example, if I were to hand out 10 sheets of paper to you tonight, just say, okay, here's a sheet of paper, here's a pen. I want you to go off in separate parts of this building and I want you to write down, first of all, what you think I've said so far tonight. Right? And then I asked you to write, well, where do you think Canada will be as a nation 100 years from now? Come back with your answers. How many different opinions or do you think there would be in the 10 people, 10 of you that went off to write? I think it would probably be 10 out of 10. But this book, we have more than 10. We have over 40 writers writing in this book, and everything agrees perfectly. There's no discrepancy in what they've written over long periods of time. An amazing miracle. But that's inspiration. That is what God directed, not man. And so this book continues to call. And I might say, well, a skeptic might say, well, you know, somebody wrote the book after all of these events, and that's been said. It was easy. I mean, it's easy to write about a prophecy after the event. But this book was around a long time before Israel became a nation in 1948. But now we have incontrovertible evidence in the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in caves from 1947 through 1952, I think it was. But starting in 1947, the Dead Sea Scrolls, as they have been called, discovered on the northwest side of the Dead Sea. These scrolls have given us evidence that the Old Testament books were written well before the time of Jesus Christ. And these are the prophecies that spoke of Jesus himself. And speaking about Jesus, Jesus fulfilled over 300 Old Testament prophecies. Over 300. He fulfilled all of those prophecies. The probability of even fulfilling 10 prophecies is almost an impossibility. The probability of fulfilling over 300 is absolutely an impossibility if it were chance. It simply cannot be done. And so, with Jesus fulfilling over 300 Old Testament prophecies, this again was done by design. This was done through the power of God. Jesus was spoken of by his apostles, who were the eyewitnesses of his life and his death and his resurrection. So, could we say that Jesus didn't exist? Or could we possibly say that, yes, Jesus existed, but he was just a great teacher. He was a phenomenal teacher, very charismatic, won the crowds over, but he certainly didn't die and then live again. That would be just totally impossible. And let's just assume that that were the case. If Jesus lived and died and did not rise from the dead, then the New Testament that we have here in before us is a complete hoax. It has no foundation. you might as well just throw it away because it's of an absolutely no value, if that were the case. Furthermore, the apostles who said, for example, in 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, the apostles who said that they heard him and they actually touched him, these apostles, all but one of them, died a violent death. I'm referring to the 12. They died a violent death for a lie. They didn't believe it. How could they believe or how could they give their lives willingly for something that didn't happen? So they believed a lie? Not very likely, is it? It's not very likely that 11 men would willingly and freely give their lives for a cause which was not true. And they knew not to be true. It wouldn't make sense. And so the message that has come on down to us in our day, that this wave that has just continued to go around the world for 2,000 years, the apostolic message, it could not be based on a lie. It would not have survived. And so, on the other hand, if, excuse me, if the apostles believed it, if they believed their message, because they were witnesses to it, there is something that goes with their message. Now, I would just like to spend a few minutes in the Gospel of John just to demonstrate this point. Gospel of John, chapter 10 and verse 10. Jesus says, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come, and he's talking about his sheep, his disciples. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Abundant life. And that was the reason why Jesus came. So if Jesus came to give us abundant life, every one of us should experience it. And I can testify to every one of you tonight that that verse is absolutely true. I can say that my life would have no value if it weren't for this gospel message. And every day that I wake up, I feel that there is point and purpose to my life. Oh, I'm not a perfect individual, don't get me wrong. But thanks be to God and his wonderful message and the wonderful hope that he gives to each one of us. There is an abundance, a huge abundance in this life. We can go to the grave with absolutely nothing. But if we have the hope of the kingdom of God, we have everything. All right, I'm going to move on. And here to John chapter 5, verse 28 and 29, where Jesus, again, he said, "Do not be amazed at this, for a time is coming when all who are in their graves will hear his voice and come out. Those who have done good will rise to live, and those who have done evil will rise to be condemned. By myself I can do nothing. I judge only as I hear, and my judgment is just, for I seek not to please myself, but him who sent me." So Jesus is telling us that there is a time when we will, if we are in the grave, when we will be raised out of those graves to live. And so there will be a resurrection to life. And that is of great comfort. And John chapter 7, verse 16 and 17, said, Jesus answered, my teaching is not my own. It comes from him who sent me. If anyone chooses to do God's will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. And that is the acid test. If we do it, if we perform it, if we live the life, we will find out that this book is from God, and that is the real test. Don't try and prove this book academically. Don't try and weigh it up, this evidence versus that evidence. That's what the critics do when they've come unstuck. Just live the book and see if it really does what it says it does. And then what it does is transforms our lives and gives our lives point, meaning and purpose. Exactly what God intended from the very beginning. And that is the acid test. And to me, that's why I believe. I don't believe just because Israel has returned to the land. That's convincing evidence in itself. But the most powerful thing for me, and the main reason why I believe, is because of the transforming power of this book on my life. And if it can change my life, it can change anybody's life. And it can certainly change yours. I believe in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And I don't think I've puzzled over anything in the Bible more than this question as to why Jesus had to die. And I don't think I'll ever stop thinking about it. But let me just share something with you. On the surface of things, it doesn't really seem right, does it, that Jesus had to die? And you mean a God of the universe who created all of this wondrous universe, he wanted this man to die? Yes, says the Bible, that's exactly it. God gave his only begotten son. He gave him, he made him an offering. But he didn't do it for God. He did it for us. The text is very clear on that. God didn't need it. We need it. And what do we need in the death of that man? You see, right in the very beginning, man came unstuck. Because man broke God's moral law. And you can't have imperfection. You can't have disobedience going on into an eternal age. It just doesn't work. Because eternity demands perfection. It's like perpetual motion. If you introduce into perpetual motion even the tiniest particle of friction, you no longer have perpetual motion. It can't go on. And in the eternal age, if you introduce just even the minutest part of imperfection, it can't go on. And so God, who is perfect and who is a moral God, he can't have his creation being immoral eternally. And so the disobedience of man in the very beginning of his existence, that had to be rectified. It couldn't persist. It couldn't go on. And how would he do it? Well, God made a very real demonstration to every one of us of what that produces. And it produces death. And we see death on every hand, but he produced it in his own son, Jesus. So that we could see that this is the result of disobedience. Not in the man who died, but in the very first man who disobeyed. And on down through the ages. But God wanted to do it. Not just to demonstrate what sin would do. God wanted Jesus to die so that he could demonstrate what God could do. And God raised him from the dead. And that's the key thing in the whole scenario of the death of Jesus Christ, is that Jesus rose from the dead. The grave couldn't hold him. So that every one of us can look and say, well, that's what sin does. And it's going to do it to me. I know it is. I know I'm going into the grave if Jesus doesn't return. But I also know that God has the power to raise me from the dead because he did it with his own son. As a demonstration. even though it was a horrific death, God let it happen to demonstrate to every one of us here what he can do. And he only had to do it once. That's the beauty of it. And so, when the Bible speaks of the resurrection that is going to take place, just as Jesus referred to it there in John chapter 5, I know it's going to happen. I know that when that day comes, I will be raised. Pray God to eternity. And so I also believe in the eternal age. Some find it hard to comprehend eternity. And when God talks about eternal life, how can we believe it? We've got no evidence because we all die. You know that the astronomers talk in light years. Have you ever calculated how long a light year is? It's beyond comprehension. And when they talk about stars out there that are millions of light years away, it's a distance that's totally incomprehensible. It's bordering on the infinite. So yes, I believe in the eternal age. If our God is so infinite that he can create a universe so perfectly balanced, so ordered, so precise, I know that his creation here upon this earth, that it can endure forever. So yeah, I believe in eternity. And I believe in eternal life. And I believe that the eternal God who has created us, that he is wise enough that his creation has a plan and it has a purpose. Everything around me tells me so. And this book teaches me how it all works together. It's a wonderful thing. So, yes, I believe. But the fool says in his heart, there is no God. Why would we be a fool?